Can we talk something else? Can we talk about something else?
Hello. Out there. We all have disturbed youths in our communities. Kids who make everyone uneasy. The warning signs are always there, but not much can be done until one of those signs turns, uproots itself, and comes charging after you down the street, red-faced, screaming stop. Bad signs. Eventually, these kids stop showing them, usually because they've grown out of it, but occasionally because they've grown into it, quietly becoming exactly what we all feared. A sleeper cell, dormant, napping until their nefarious nature is fully nurtured, awakening once they see a sign. Welcome to Dark Topic. I'm your host, Jack Luna. This is a true crime happening. Napper. It was the late 1980s when the so-called Green Chain Rapist began terrorizing the sleepy suburb of Plumstead, located in southeast London, England. The Green Chain, or the Green Chain Walk, refers to a thick, winding belt of forest peppered with pathways that run in and around Plumstead Common. An excellent place to raise children, that is, until a rapist targeting lone women pushing prams decides to make it his feeding grounds. A lot of places to hide along the Green Chain, a lot of places to run. And it would take 5 years of authorities scratching their heads over the absurdity of nearly 100 unsolved attacks before they could put a name and face to the predator, who managed to do as he pleased, first feasting as the Green Chain Rapist, then gorging on seconds as the Plumstead Ripper. Let me take off my top. That's an unfortunate bit of misspeak there. Don't let me take off my top. A lot of mistakes and misses by investigators in this case, so maybe fitting, unlike my top. That's why I need to get it off. Let me take it from the top and explore a handful of these horrific assaults that gripped the Green Chain before ripping it. August 10th, 1989. The Green Chain Rapist, aka the GCR, spies from the woods on a two-story brick Plumstead Common home. At around 7 a.m., he spots a woman in a nightdress open the back door to a home he's been watching to let a cat out. In doing so, she lets it out of the bag that a single mother, the GCR's favorite, may live here. The Green Chain Rapist is a prolific peeping Tom. Over the next hour, he goes to different vantage points in the woods, watching each window closely from the cover of birch trees, his pale face blending with their peeling parchment. A young mother living at Purit Road with her children, aged 8 and 5, has soon been confirmed by the GCR as the only adult in the house. The backyard is separated from the common by a chain-link fence that is in need of repair. He steps over it after observing the mother hand out breakfast to the kids, then head upstairs to get ready for work. The GCR enters the home, quietly through the front door, and past the kids who are too busy eating to notice him. At 8:30 a.m., as the mother maybe is dressing or applying makeup following her shower, the GCR, wearing a beige scarf to cover the lower half of his face, enters her bedroom holding a utility knife in one hand and a finger to his guarded lips in the other. The terrified mother, fearing mainly for her children, does as she's told. This is a running theme with the GCR. He targets mothers with their kids, as he knows they'll be more compliant with a threat to their babies looming. GCR demands his victim get on the bed, where he immediately pulls her shirt off and ties her wrists with flex cord. He then rapes her, ejaculating inside her. Quick and dirty, it's just how it was. Later, this perpetrator, the GCR, would become known for his impotence. Most of the rapes occurred in the Green Chain, in public, which perhaps affected his performance, but not here in the relative safety of a home. Before leaving, he untied the victim and ordered she stand in the corner and count to 20. Upon exiting, he said, quote, "Do you want a bit of advice? Don't leave your back door open." The GCR then calmly walked downstairs, past the children, and out the front door. The woman, her name was Julia, watched from her window as he left through the common and soon lost sight of him. She reported the rape to the police and was able to provide a sketch. A white male, mid-20s, 5'8 or so, slim build, face like a potato. It could have been any young man from the whole of England with that description, though not a tall one. 5'8 was a majorly misleading number. The GCR's true height was around 6'3. It turns out he had poor posture, as most insecure young men of height do. Though he was no slouch when it came to approaching women with a utility knife. In October of 1989, a 23-year-old local weirdo named Bob Napper confessed to his mother, Pauline, that he had raped a woman in her home at Plumstead Common. Pauline contacted the police to have this investigated and was told that no offense had been reported in Plumstead. Pauline thought that her troubled potato-faced boy must be having another one of his fantasy episodes. He was a little sick in the head, you see. Police did have a report of a rape, but it did not happen in Plumstead Common. It was recorded to have happened in Wynn's Common, and by a much shorter perpetrator. Wynn's Common is where the home was technically located, overlooking Plumstead Common. A major oversight, but an honest mistake, though mistakes like this are unforgivable under such circumstances, perhaps nearly 100 rapes and 3 known murders could have been avoided had it not been made. Oh well. March 10th, 1992. The GCR spots a potential victim walking the darkening woods of the Green Chain alone at around 8:45 p.m. The victim was making her way through an alley when she heard footsteps about 10 yards behind her. She walked faster through a courtyard and into another alleyway. As she hurried along, the GCR quietly closed the distance and grabbed her right arm from behind. Holding a knife to her stomach, he dragged her over to an open garage and pushed her up against the wall. He tried to kiss her and told her to open her jacket. She refused, so he forced her clothing up and viciously grabbed at her breasts. Then, without warning, he punched her hard several times on her left cheek, smashing her head into the wall. He pulled off her jeans and underwear and pushed his prey to the ground, kicking her legs apart. He pulled down his pants and attempted to rape her, but he couldn't get an erection. The GCR stood up and kicked her in the head 6 or 7 times, then hurried off down the alleyway. The victim managed to get to her intended destination, a friend's house nearby. This friend couldn't recognize her for the damage done, and Bob Napper, whom we'll meet properly after a few more improper acts, remained unrecognizable as well. He'd wear a balaclava often. Though he was openly out and about most days, and when he wasn't stalking women, he was walking them, home from work, as they feared the Green Chain rapist. March 18th, 1992. Vista Field off King John's Walk, a link of the Green Chain. This is a more rural area where the walkways run through open fields, where horses graze. At about 8 p.m., a woman is spotted by the GCR walking south on King John's Walk. It was dark, especially since the area had no lighting at the time. He had chosen it for this reason. The GCR knew every link of the Green Chain Walk, intimately, knew every tree for that matter. He spent so much time rubbed up behind them, spying, one with the wood. The victim heard his steps coming from behind her, and she turned, but it wasn't quite right. Something had spooked the GCR, and he walked briskly by, soon disappearing up ahead on the path, a shadow shifting back into the blackness. It was as if he'd never existed, but he had, and his quarry can sense that he was now hiding up ahead, which was correct. The young woman then decided to take a short cut across Vista Field to where her parents' house was. Going off the path at night wasn't advised. That was, unless the Green Chain rapist was waiting around the next bend. She didn't get far before the GCR quietly caught up, moving swiftly through the grass like a 6-foot snake, soon confronting her with a 6-inch knife to make up for his 6-year-old size. You get the idea. 666. The devil couldn't get it up. And the knife often would work as substitute. He told her to get down on her knees, promising, quote, that he wasn't going to hurt her or screw her. He just wanted to put his tongue in her mouth. Oh, well, then by all means, then. He knelt between her legs and pushed her backwards, lifting her clothing and lying on top of her, kissing and sucking at her breasts. And such details are rarely shared. Too sexual, too fucked up. But of course, this is about power, too, and it needs to be spoken about. The GCR took his time terrorizing and often liked to make fantasy, pretending perhaps to be with his girlfriend on a lover's lane during these acts. The GCR then asked the girl to, quote, go down on me. She pretended not to know what that meant. Frustrated, he tried to rape her but couldn't get an erection. When he finally gave up, he placed the knife between her bare legs and said, you could have got this. He moved the knife up her body between her breasts and to her chin. Then he got up and walked away. The victim dressed and ran to a nearby shop where she called police, who were like, shit, we keep on getting calls like this. May 24th, 1992, 2 p.m. Another unnamed victim was traveling the Green Chain Walk, this time in broad daylight, this time pushing a stroller with a 2-year-old girl in it, her daughter. Up ahead, the young mother noticed the figure of a man in the distance crossing the path, going from woods to woods. She continued, eventually passing the spot where the shadow had crossed. The GCR, you'd think, would have crossed twice, once the path and twice this young woman's mind, but news spread funny in 1992. Unevenly and not nearly as thick as today. Once the GCR was satisfied with the thrill of ambush, he stepped out 10 yards behind the unsuspecting mother and quickly approached her, holding a rope. The victim heard footsteps, then felt something fall across her face before it tightened around her neck. She instinctively let go of the stroller. It rolled ahead for a moment while the GCR yanked her to the ground and landed several hard blows to her head and body. Violence was the main motivation. He wanted to hurt women more than have them. GCR tried to remove her top, but she resisted, so he pulled down her shorts to rape her, but again was not able to get an erection. He gave her another shot to the eye, then stood up suddenly, as if remembering he had somewhere else to be, then pulled up his pants and ran off. The victim was able to stagger to her mother-in-law's door, where she collapsed, the stroller again rolling away a moment. She suffered severe bruising to her head and an injury to the right eye that resulted in a loss of vision. Nobody could see or understand where this all could be headed or where it was coming from. The slew of victims, estimated between 80 and over 100 in a 5-year span, provided a description of the rapist: white, slim, 5'7", 5'8", short brown, mousy hair parted on the side, spotted complexion, between the ages of 20 and 30 years old. Often the Green Chain rapist would wear a balaclava, but not always. DNA samples were recovered from some attacks. DNA was in its infancy, but they still kept it. The DNA would match eventually to one assailant. Many suspects were swabbed, but the one they needed had refused to give a sample. A local weirdo who had been asked through his mother to come to the station, but had to this point failed to show. Robert Knapper had been overlooked and then forgotten due to his true height, half a foot taller than the suspect they pursued. Knapper would soon wake and stretch, but for now, he remained a slim, sleeping giant. Robert Clive Knapper was born February 25th, 1966, in Erith, London, England. He was the eldest son of Brian, a driving instructor, and his mum Pauline Knapper. He was witness to the violence inflicted on his mother by his father throughout his childhood. By the time Knapper was 9, his parents divorced, and his father, after stalking and terrorizing the family for a while, decided to start over in Australia. Young Knapper was devastated. He and his father had been close. Napper had even opened up to his father at a young age that he thought that he might be going crazy. There wasn't much support for the troubled boy, and even less once Dad left. Though he did receive some reassurance from his old man that if little Bobby Napper was anything like him, then yes, he was probably mad. Napper would later be diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome and paranoid schizophrenia, though society diagnosed him as weird. Napper had difficulties at school. He was a loner, never fit in, and was an easy target for bullies. Everybody hated him, actually. And Napper hated everybody. At the age of 12, a family friend offered to take Napper camping, and while there, he sexually assaulted him, which didn't help matters much. The family friend was arrested, and Napper became extremely reclusive, unable to sort out what had happened to him and developing a perverse, sadistic outlook that he practiced on his siblings, beating them up, confining them, spying on his sister in the shower while whacking off. Pretty normal older brother stuff in the 70s, though not acceptable today. In August of 1986, 20-year-old Napper experienced his first arrest. He pled guilty to carrying a loaded air rifle in public and shooting it. He was given a conditional discharge for 1 year. He had loads of fantasy stories to tell, which pissed everyone off with their clear fabrication. Napper claimed that he'd met the Queen while in prison and that he'd once been taken by the IRA and tortured. He said that his fingers had been cut off by the IRA, but he was able to miraculously grow them back. Needless to say, Napper should have been locked up early, just not in a prison cell, but a padded one. In his 20s, he found work at a plastics factory as a machine operator, sorting and packing and snipping. The job was pretty mundane and boring, easy. Napper was described as a good worker and created no real problems, other than being considered a creep. By the late 80s, early 90s, when the Green Chain Rapist and Plumstead Ripper were active, Napper lived alone in a flat on Plumstead High Street. As mentioned, at night, some of his female co-workers who felt unsafe walking the Green Chain, they would ask Robert to walk them home. Napper was a strange fellow at work and known privately as, quote, the creep, for the way he stared at female colleagues and for the hunched, muttering manner of his whilst working. But still, the girls felt he was harmless and that perhaps his bizarre nature would scare off an attacker. Don't worry, ladies, you're safe with me. I know the Green Chain like the back of my father's hand. Not my father. He left mother and us, but his hand. I knew that, oh yes. And so on and so on. The creep was mostly quiet. Until he wasn't. Despite some early warning signs, Napper managed to blend in. The only one who knew better was his mother. Remember that in 1989, Napper confessed to her that he raped a woman in Plumstead Common, and she believed him, even if the police would not. Police later believed that Napper was responsible for most of the 70 to over 100 rapes and assaults in the Commons reported between 1989 and 1993. In 1992, there was a report of a man attempting to print local police letterhead at a print shop, and police soon arrested Robert Napper after a short chase from the print shop. With his arrest, they were able to search his one-room flat and get his fingerprints. He kept his place very tidy. In it, they found a red metal toolbox containing several hunting knives, a pistol with a bunch of ammunition, and a map with markings on it. Napper was sentenced to 3 months in prison for attempting to impersonate police and for unlawfully possessing a firearm. The map and the remaining contents of the red toolbox that made up a hit kit were not linked to the Green Chain rapes, even though this map had notes and markings on locations that corresponded with where some of the Green Trail rapes had occurred. One of the locations, clearly marked and circled, a Plumstead Common patch of birch trees that provided cover and a view of the home where a woman had been raped upstairs back in 1989 while her children ate breakfast. On the A to Z map, Everything was, in a way, spelled out. Spots to hide, spots to stalk, spots special to his spree. To Napper, it read like a menu, of which murder was about to be added. July 15th, 1992, 10 a.m., near the windmill on Wimbledon Common, London. Ah, yes, the windmill at Wimbledon. Nearby the tennis courts, 23-year-old mother, wife, and part-time model Rachel Nichols' body was found in the brush of a Wimbledon park frequented by hundreds of people a day. Maybe 200 people had passed her body in the brush before a man saw her feet that day. Not a place you would expect an attack to happen. Wimbledon is a well-off part of London and synonymous with snobbishness. How dare someone kill someone in Wimbledon? Especially publicly. My dear God, wait till you hear how it happened, lady. Rachel had been taking a stroll with her dog, Molly, a lab mix, and her son, Alex, too. Napper approached and put a knife to her throat. She dropped the leash and the dog ran away. As its owner was dragged into the woods, the 2-year-old boy crying in the drag, Napper smacks him in the head with a red toolbox, his hit kit, and the toddler goes to sleep. Rachel attacks Napper, and for her effort, is stabbed a lot in the brush, then raped, or attempted to be. The knife does most of the work. Napper flees, and the mother, Rachel, is left to die beside her baby. Baby Alex soon wakes up, confused by all the damage to Mummy, and tries to bandage her up with fallen leaves and trash. A man walking by spots this serious game of doctor, and as he approaches through the trees, hiding the mess, he hears a little voice saying, quote, "Get up, Mummy." Rachel will never get up. She's gone, as is Napper. He's seen washing his hands in a nearby stream. Footprints left by the water are later cast and determined to be size 9 Adidas. The 2, almost 3-year-old is questioned, but can only talk about his missing dog, Molly. What happened to Mommy maybe was too tough to talk about, especially for a kid just learning how to talk. Rachel's husband, Andre, gives a statement to the press, quote, "This person has to be found before another person is killed and another family destroyed." Rachel had been stabbed 49 times. This level of violence suggests that because he couldn't perform the rape, Napper instead stabbed her out of rage and humiliation. The use of a knife seems to often represent an erection for a killer in such cases. Rachel had been attacked and murdered in front of her 2-year-old son, Alex. The police had not much to go on, but witnesses were interviewed, including one who had seen Napper washing his hands of the matter, and a sketch was made. Because of his resemblance to the sketch and witnesses putting him in the Wimbledon Commons on the day of the murder, a local weirdo named Colin Stagg became the prime suspect. He lived alone near the common and used it regularly to walk his dog. He was taken in for an interview where he adamantly denied the crime. He told police he woke up that morning with a bad headache, so he took his dog out for a walk through the common to clear it. He returned home at 9:30 a.m., then fell asleep on his couch, then was awakened around 10:30 a.m. when he heard helicopters and police banging down his door. Black magic symbols were found all over his house, which he tried to explain had purpose in the Wicca religion and represented life, not the perceived evils of Satan. Police still felt confident they had their man. He was a probable suspect. He resembled the witness description of a man seen washing his hands in the creek, then running through the brush around Wimbledon through a cemetery on the morning of the murder. Stagg had a believable story, but no one in his life to confirm his alibi, except his dog that didn't run away. But unfortunately, it couldn't talk. The pressure from the public to catch the brazen killer kept police focused on Stagg instead of looking for other suspects. It didn't help that this occurred in broad daylight to an affluent woman of an affluent area. It shouldn't make a difference, but when the rich feel threatened, You know damn well that something is going to get done about it, even if an innocent man needs to be locked up. Jobs are on the line. Higher-ups are going to slash them. Either way, they secured a confession of sorts from Colin Stagg, and he was locked up on suspicion of the murder, which, for the time being, was good enough for everyone around Wimbledon. At this point, there was no reason to connect this Wimbledon murder with the Green Chain rapist in Plumstead Common due to the distance apart, about 20 miles. Charges against Stagg would later be dropped when a judge threw out his case after learning of how Stagg had confessed. Investigators had used a honey trap sting to secure a shaky confession. A concerned lover of Stagg's had come to police believing that because of Stagg's proclivity for rough sex and knife play, he should be a suspect. Over the course of months, this woman recorded conversations with Stagg where she led him to confess to the Wimbledon murder. He would not openly confess until finally relenting as part of what she posed as a sexual fantasy of hers to role play as the Wimbledon victim and he tell her of all the horrible things he did, much of which was known publicly by this point. This was, of course, fucked. And investigators had to know they were setting Stagg up for a fall here. I mean, what guy can resist cosplaying as a rapist and killer of a mother while her child groggily watches? Any of us, fella? Could you resist that? DNA from the Wimbledon scene would not be properly recovered until 2004, when the science had evolved enough to test microscopic blood from the victim's sweater, which was eventually matched to Robert Knapper. But by then, Stagg had been humiliated for a decade after having been arrested, paraded by the Wimbledon media like a fruit. The Wimbledon tennis trophy has a pineapple on it. Then put away for a year until it all blew over, and a judge freed him. Colin Stagg received £700,000, a hefty amount, and an apology for having spent nearly a decade as a pariah of the area, preceded by 14 months in prison, thought to be the killer of a mother whom he'd first attempted to rape in front of her child, whom he'd hit in the head with a fucking rock, is what they thought, in broad daylight, in Wimbledon, which isn't considered a cool crime to other prisoners, despite it being in Wimbledon. At least most other criminals didn't find this to be a cool crime. Knapper, who was locked up by then for this next shocking murder, no doubt thought that what Stagg was in for, like pineapple, was pretty sweet. Quince, everyone. I used to think that great cookware was something you admired on Instagram more than actually owned. Quince is what changed that for me. Sorry, just had to turn off the stove there. It's thoughtfully made, good looking, and it makes cooking feel easier, genuinely. Quince makes high-end cookware that actually lasts. Stainless steel pots and pans that heat evenly. Chef's knives that stay sharp. Ceramic non-stick that actually works. A cast iron Dutch oven. Plus tabletop essentials in new spring patterns and colors. Everything you need to cook well and make your table look intentional and effortless. Here's what got me. This is high-quality cookware. When I'm cooking with it, it feels like the stuff you'd find at luxury kitchen stores. But Quince costs 50 to 60% less. Same premium materials, half the price. I got myself some knives, and I got myself a stainless steel pan. And I'm cooking up a storm over here. I just burped because, God, I've been eating so much food. With all that good stuff, I've been cooking with my new Quince gear. I never thought of myself as a chef, but better cookware honestly makes me want to spend more time in the kitchen. You're cooking dinner tonight and tomorrow. Stop fighting with pans that stick or handles that wobble. You deserve cookware that lasts. Right now, get free shipping and 365-day returns when you go to quince.com/darktopic. That's a full year to cook with it and love it, and you will. Now available in Canada, too. Don't keep replacing cookware that frustrates you. Go to quince.com/darktopic for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/darktopic. Mood, everybody. Did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? And they have found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to create gummies, baked goods, and flour for whatever the type of buzz you want. I'm talking once again about Mood.com. They have an incredible line of cannabis gummies. And you can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code DARKTOPIC. Forget one-size-fits-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. I'm a big fan of their Sexual Euphoria Advanced Gummies. I take them by myself. I like the 15 milligram Sexual Euphoria Advanced THC Gummies. They make me go from G-Wiz to Cheese Whiz in 15 minutes flat. Probably just lost the ad there. But I'm telling you, 5-15 minutes, you're ready to go. Going to the bathroom. Because I'm not involving my girl in this situation. Listen, you can find gummies to just get you high pretty much anywhere these days. But Mood's functional gummies combine premium, federally legal THC with targeted botanicals to help you get into the perfect mood. And everything ships discreetly right to your door. No dispensary lines, no awkward conversations, just better days and nights delivered to your doorstep. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code DARKTOPIC. So head to Mood.com, find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code DARKTOPIC when you check out to save 20% on your first order. Try today at Mood.com.
Do you live for Sunday dinner and that slow-cooked all-day flavor of a pot roast that falls apart with a dull spoon? Thanks to Omaha Steaks, I'm never shy about the proteins when it comes to Sunday dinners at our house. Every steak is aged to perfection to maximize tenderness and hand-cut by master butchers in America's heartland. Get 50% off the world's best everyday protein. Go to omahasteaks.com for 50% off site-wide during their semi-annual sale. And for an extra $35 off, use promo code YUM at checkout. That's 50% off at omahasteaks.com and an extra $35 off with promo code YUM at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. Go to https://omahasteaks.com to get 50% off site-wide during their semi-annual sale. And use promo code YUM at checkout for an extra $35 off. Minimum purchase may apply.
The GCR, the Green Chain Rapist, continued to terrorize Plumstead, culminating in another mother murder on November 3rd, 1993, a year and a half past Wimbledon. The victims were mother Samantha Bissett, 27, and her daughter, Jasmine, 4 years old. Some background info on the mother. Samantha was an only child, born February 25th, 1967. She had a comfortable childhood and excelled academically, but when her father died unexpectedly in 1980, she and her mother moved to Dundee, Scotland, where she didn't adjust very well. She and her father had both been artists and bonded over this. When he died, when she was a young teenager, so did a big part of Samantha. The relationship she had with her mother became strained, and Samantha spent most of her time with her grandmother. Her grades suffered, and she fell into a crowd that were into the drug scene. Samantha eventually dropped out of school and left Scotland, moving to the south of England. Her drug use would continue, and she lived the life of a hippie for a while. Sometime later, she entered rehab and met a man named Andrew McNeil. He was a social worker of hers. The relationship was on and off, and when Andrew left to return to his hometown of Hampshire, she found herself pregnant by him. She was only 22, and this social worker of hers didn't want anything to do with this situation. Samantha, she didn't pursue the matter. Instead, she decided to fix her life herself. She gave up the drugs, was able to kick the habit. Who said social workers can't make a difference? Jasmine was born on July 20th of 1989. Samantha moved into a hostel for single mothers, and there she met Conrad Elam, a.k.a. Cozy. Cozy was a true friend. They never became a real couple. They were friends with benefits, and he was kind to both Samantha and Jasmine. They moved in together at 1A Heathfield Terrace in Winscommon, on August 21st, 1989, a 1960s three-story terraced row of houses that backed onto Wynn's Common. Samantha, she worked hard to give her daughter everything. She was a good mother, strong-minded, and her life revolved around her daughter. There are plenty of home movies that have circulated through documentaries on the case, and they are heartbreaking, considering what was to become of the young mother and her beautiful little girl. Back to November 3rd, 1993. Samantha left her flat to pick up Jasmine at Abbey Wood Nursery. She walked the 25-minute green chain walk there. Anne had arranged for a cab to pick her up there at 3:30 p.m. when Jasmine got off of school to take her and her daughter back home. Four-year-old Jasmine emerged with another drawing to add to the growing gallery on her bedroom wall. The taxi driver dropped them off at 3:40 p.m., and he would be the last person to see them alive. After dinner, Samantha gave Jasmine a bath, and at about 7 p.m., she took her to her room to read her a book, and once Jasmine was asleep, she put her in her cot. A neighbor heard the clattering of dishes as Samantha cleaned up and went to bed. At about 3 a.m., another neighbor heard screams and looked at her window, seeing lights on at 1A Heathfield Terrace. It's the bottom apartment. You ever seen an apartment building? I mean, there's multiple floors, but they have the bottom apartment is accessible from the common, from the green chain trail, from the woods, from where, no doubt, Napper had been spying. The screaming that this witness heard stopped almost as soon as it started, and this witness went back to bed. Another witness later said that he had heard two men arguing from the flat, and one of these men was heard to say, quote, "Leave it be." Later, this would be realized to be Napper talking to himself, likely in the midst of a schizophrenic episode where he was using two voices to work himself through the horror he was inflicting. Other tenants at Heathfield Terrace entered their flats through a common entryway. Samantha's, like I said, was the end unit on the ground floor, and it had its own separate entryway down a flight of stairs along the side of the building, and then up top it had a balcony to the second floor, which you could almost jump to from a little hill below it. I mean, if you were like 6'3" and standing up straight. Samantha had spotted a face in her window two nights previous and had told her boyfriend Cozy about it. This was no doubt the prolific peeper and green chain rapist, and now the Plumstead Ripper, the Wimbledon killer, Robert Napper. Napper climbed onto the balcony, then got in through the open door there. He met Samantha in a hallway after she had put her baby to bed. She was dragged to the living room, stabbed to death, sprawled out on her back in an awkward position. The ligaments at her knees were cut through to achieve this pose, which some believe to be a mocking of a sexual position. Napper maybe had observed Samantha and Cozy having sex. That's what some people think. While spying on them and did this, he rapes her body. Samantha had been cut open from her throat to her vulva, ribs cut through, organs exposed and disturbed. Later at autopsy, her body was pieced back together. And it was discovered that an area of about 6 square inches of her stomach wall was missing, and it was never found. Napper maybe ate it, or took it as a keepsake. All of this would later be discovered by Samantha's trusted friend and sometimes lover, Cozy, her roommate, her and Jasmine's roommate, who reported the murder. After coming home after work, police arrived. Cozy was on the front stoop, chain-smoking. His hands were red from the dye used in his profession. That's unfortunate. Red-handed. He would be a suspect for some time until cleared by DNA evidence collected from Napper's rape of the child. After having his fun with the mother, Napper went upstairs and found Jasmine, 4 years old, asleep in her cot. When investigators later entered the girl's bedroom, it appeared as if she was sleeping, but in reality, she had been smothered in her cot, and vaginal swabs later taken were stained with blood and semen, indicating, obviously, she'd been sexually assaulted before her death. The semen was recovered. Let's do a quote here from Detective Superintendent Mickey Banks. Quote, "I walked through to the living room and the body was displayed. It was the most horrendous scene I've ever seen in 32 years of police service. It was awful. It was as if a postmortem had been conducted on this poor girl. It was absolutely horrendous. End quote. And the child, well, what can be said about that? Every fingerprint from the home was lifted and identified as either Samantha's, Jasmine's, Jasmine's friends, or Cozy's. Jasmine had recently had a birthday party, her fourth birthday party. Little kid handprints covered the entire home as a result. But there was only those four sets of fingerprints, or fucking who knows how many people were at the birthday party. But there was nothing outside of that. So they're wondering, did the killer wear gloves? He must have. It has been established in criminal law that no two fingerprints can be identical. Investigators had three prints that would soon turn that idea on its head. There was one on the balcony, one on Jasmine's door jamb, and one on Jasmine's cot that were initially identified to be her mother Samantha's. But after a review of the initial findings and a double check of the prints, it is discovered that the prints I just mentioned were so similar to Samantha's that they were assumed to be hers initially. But on second look, they didn't belong to Mother Samantha. They belonged to a man named Robert Napper. Incredible. First, the mistake, but second, that Napper and Samantha's prints were so similar as to make a mistake possible. After gathering background information and a photo of Napper, young white male in his early 20s, short greasy hair, spotty complexion, weak chin, potato face, another officer commented on how much he looked like the witness photos of the green chain walk rapist. The woods were closing in. Napper's prints and DNA would soon reveal him as the dreaded GCR. A footprint in blood at the scene were determined to be from an Adidas low-rise trainer size 9. Got that print right. Although the same sneaker cast was found by the Creek in Wimbledon, this crime was not initially linked to the Wimbledon case, as there was already a suspect in custody in that case. LOL. Speaking of LOL, and I use that because this is funny, but I don't feel like laughing, check this out. Before the fingerprints were finally sorted out, a Crime Watch episode was made on this double homicide that was meant to jog the memory of any potential witness or anyone who might know the killer. It was put out publicly on TV in England there, and calls came pouring in afterwards. They all pointed to one man, the actor who played Napper in the Crime Watch dramatization. LMFAO. These fucking people were calling in the actor who played the assailant in the Crime Watch video. I'm going to shoot my... I'm glad they don't have guns here in Canada. I don't have a gun. I would shoot myself right now. Most people are so fucking stupid. Have you noticed? It's almost like, why bother sometimes? I got a good life. I don't mean it. But Jesus Christ, when you get out there a bit, I'm going home. Shooting myself. Robert Napper's prints are on file because in 1992 he was caught making police letterhead at a printing shop. He was arrested on suspicion of impersonation of police. Once the prints from this murder scene are confirmed to be his, surveillance happens upon him. They watch him taking long walks, taking the train, taking the bus. He's walking all along the green chain trails. He stops at a shop and buys pornography. He looks at knives in another shop. He's getting off at bus and train stops beyond his area eventually, then walking home. They realize he's trying to shake the tail that's on him. He's aware. On May 24th, 1994, not long after surveillance started, I thought they should have fucking arrested him immediately. He got his prints. They arrested him in the morning. Napper didn't get up for work that morning. They were worried he had smelled him out and ran out the back door maybe in the middle of the night. He had actually been fired from his job at the plastics factory the day before this. So when they're surveilling, they don't see him come out. They go up, they knock on the door. He comes to the door with his shirt off. And he's like, hi, what do you guys want? They go into the house. They arrest him. They find his Adidas size 9 shoes that are a match to the blood prints at this recent murder, and also later a match to the casts done by the creek, but I'll talk about that later. They find the red toolbox with knives and rope and maps. Again, they had found this in a previous arrest, but they find these again. A detective, Jackman, brings them in, and Napper says, quote, I heard of the murders in the paper. I don't know Samantha Bissett, end quote. Detective Jackman's like, why the fuck are you bringing that up? And he'll go on to write a book about this case. It's called Napper, Through a Glass Darkly. Doesn't have all the information on this case, to be honest with you. It's okay. Later, a pistol was found near Napper's flat, wrapped and partially buried. It was discovered by two boys who handed it in. Prints on it match Napper's. Ballistics find a match to a recent random shooting through a local woman's window. He was doing a lot of work, this guy. He was terrorizing this entire Plumstead Common for 5 years. After Napper's arrest, police obtained his DNA and they were able to match him to many sex attacks, including the four mentioned in the GCR portion of this episode, the Green Chain Rapist. I'm not afraid to say it. It's just a lot to say. Three of the four women positively identified Napper from a lineup. Three of the four women that I mentioned in the beginning. It had been 5 years since the fourth woman had been raped, and she couldn't be sure. Add to that, on that case, the DNA tests for her case were later nullified due to an error in the lab. So many errors. I think there's about 7 errors in this case. Six or seven. There was still no doubt Napper was responsible for the Green Chain Walk rapes, even though he denies it to this day, though the evidence was overwhelming. The A to Z maps had murder sites and rape sites marked, over 100 places of interest on his maps. Those maps found in Napper's red toolbox would later show he had circled the locations not only of rapes or attempted rapes, but of where he would watch the women before attacking them and routes he liked to stalk. He would act on the mother's instinct to protect her children from being harmed and would attack and rape women in front of their children because, as I've mentioned, he saw the child as a way to keep her complicit, active and responsive during the rape. A lot of good that did because he couldn't get it up. He also, some psychologists think, enjoyed seeing children in pain and crying and all that shit. I hope that's not the case, that he enjoyed it, but does it really fucking matter? He pled guilty in the Samantha and Jasmine, 4-year-old Jasmine Bissett case. Napper, he was convicted of manslaughter by reason of diminished responsibility. He was sent to a maximum psychiatric hospital, the infamous Broadmoor. And I know that manslaughter by reason of diminished responsibility sentence bothers people. It bothers me a lot. But he was sent for life. I mean, once he's in Broadmoor, he's staying. This guy is actually very crazy. On October 9th, 1995, this is when that happened. As for the Wimbledon Rachel Nichol case, if you remember, I don't want to go over it, but she was dragged into the woods. She was stabbed 49 times in front of her 2-year-old Alex. He was hit in the head with the red toolbox, knocked out when he was crying. And when he woke up, he was trying to help his mom with leaves, playing a game of doctor, like I said. I guess I said the whole thing again. The A to Z map later showed a faint marking, more of a scratch, around the Wimbledon Commons area where Rachel had been murdered. Perhaps he was ashamed of that one and trying to scratch it out. It would take a decade, but once the science caught up, in July of 2004, forensics was able to obtain microscopic blood samples from Rachel's clothing and discovered a small amount of blood that was not hers. To remind you, that's the Wimbledon scene. DNA was then run again in the Rachel Nichol case, and finally, it was matched to Napper. Also, a fleck of red paint that matched his red toolbox, recovered from little boy at the time, Alex's hair after being bashed with the fucking toolbox, was matched to that toolbox eventually. Also, Napper's shoes, I think it's a different set, were recovered from storage, and they say this is miraculous that they were able to recover these shoes. Those were matched to the casts taken by the Creek from the Wimbledon situation. All of this a little late, and nothing surprises me anymore with this particular case. You'd figure the shoes, whether they're the same shoes or other shoes, should have been like a sign that he had something to do with that because they're size 9 Adidas. I mean, I might not have done my research right. And, you know, that's always a possibility. But fuck, I mean, I think I did. You'd figure the shoes could have been solved way sooner in this case. But hey, apparently they were in storage and everyone had to wait 10 years to officially connect all this. Two obviously connected cases. I mean, the mother and child attacks and murders stopped and the green chain saw a drop of about 100% in rapes and attacks once Napper was put to bed safe and sound in Broadmoor. Well, I shouldn't call Broadmoor, of all places, safe or sound. Anyways, it drives you crazy, doesn't it? On December 18th, 2008, Robert Napper was convicted of the manslaughter of Rachel Nickel on the grounds of diminished responsibility. Whoops! I accidentally fucking put a knife to her throat, dragged her into the woods, and stabbed her 49 times after smashing her 2-year-old kid in the head with my toolbox. Oops! Manslaughter. And speaking of being driven to crazy, he was quickly given a lift back to Broadmoor after sentencing, where he will remain dormant once again for life. Napper. Thank you for listening. You know the drill. Dark Topic Plus for exclusive content. Links in the show notes. Lots of exclusive content if you want it. I'm going to let that case rest as is. Sometimes when I ramble here at the end, I steal the show, or at least unnecessarily distract from the show. I'm doing well. I hope all... I'm doing really well. You hear how I said that? I'm doing well, guys. How you guys doing out there? It's so cold here in my drafty studio. Maybe I should have wore pants. Snow pants. I mean, like earlier I talked about taking my shirt off. Now I got my pants off. I'm completely naked. It's super cold. I'm going to go inside and take a nap. Put some clothes on first. I don't like to nap when I'm completely naked. I don't sleep naked. It makes me feel like someone could just come into the house and then I got to get up naked and I'm running around trying to put pants and shirt on and horrible things are happening to my family whilst that's happening. Also, sleeping naked just doesn't feel right. I think my nipples are fairly sensitive. Anyways, I don't want to talk anymore at the end here. Please rate, review, share, and until next time, keep those eyes cocked, those doors locked, and stay paranoid. I could have sworn I'm hearing things in my fucking mic at the end there. There's something fucking weird going on in my mic. Anyways.